All sounds are disturbances in a medium, solid, liquid, gas, plasma. In a solid, earthquake. In a liquid, the songs of the humpback whale. In a gas, the aurora borealis. In plasma, solar storm. Noises are disturbances in the medium that are also disturbances in the mind, or whatever you want to call our sensorium, our perceptual apparatus, our conceptual cortices. One sound only, involuntarily raises the hackles of the necks of all humans within hearing, called the gride, G-R-I-D-E. This one sound, universally experienced as noise, may not be a disturbance of the mind. It may be neuropsychological, neurophysiological, or plainly biological. It is most commonly heard as the scraping of fingernails across a chalkboard. The mere reading or speaking of those words, scraping a fingernail across a chalkboard, may raise the hackles of your neck. In all other cases, the crinkling of candy wrappers, or the yipping of coyotes, a low-frequency hum or high-energy hoopla. Noise is never so much a question of the intensity of sound as of the intensity of relationships between deep past and present, imagined or experienced, between one generation and the next, gods or mortals, between country and city, herb and suburb, between one class and another, between the sexes. Wherefore my book, Making Noise from Babel to the Big Bang and Beyond, a history of how noise in the West comes to be heard and made, defined and redefined, suppressed and amplified, until its metaphorical power overarches the acoustic. As a register of the intensity of relationships, noise has a fourfold history. First, the chronicle of changing soundscapes, how each era and culture lives within its own ambience of sounds. Next, the annals of sounds earmarked as pleasant or obnoxious, how each era, culture, and rank hears or does not hear, and welcomes or disdains the sounds around it. Next, the career of noise itself as variously apprehended, how each era, culture, occupation, or discipline reconstitutes the notion and nature of noise. Contingent upon these, finally, are narratives of noise-making and noise-breaking, how noise in each era, culture, and class has been denounced or defended, defiantly produced, or determinedly deadened. For English speakers, noises other than grides arrive in three subsets. Either they are sounds so faint that we must strain to hear them and doubt ourselves in the hearing of them, or argue among ourselves about their audibility, as with supposed subliminal advertising, or use them to tease or torture. Call this the noise of almost nothing. Or they are sounds that are annoyingly indefinable, as in, what's that darn noise? Or they are identifiable sounds that are intrinsically upsetting. The word intrinsic is, of course, problematic. In fact, trying to define and demonstrate what is intrinsic lies at the crux of disputes over noise law and anti-noise enforcement. It lies also at the core of debates over the ambit and nature of music. I will discuss the problem of the intrinsic in a bit. Just now, I must elaborate on the first two subsets, the noise of almost nothing and the noise of the indefinable. Hearing often deteriorates as we age, and in particular the ability to hear high frequencies, but hearing remains the most faithful of our senses, ordinarily lingering with us as we move toward death. Sight, taste, touch, proprioception, smell, these senses, and in that order, are usually more compromised as we grow older. So it is on sound that our bodies and minds increasingly rely to situate ourselves, secure our context, assure our safety. It is therefore disturbing, distressing, not to be able to identify a sound in the immediate environment. So, that word, noise. The noise of almost nothing may simply be too faint. But given that individual acuity is idiosyncratic and different tonal frequencies are differently audible at different decibel levels or within different constellations of sounds, faintness is rarely so simple. What you hear faintly, I may not hear at all, or hear as something very different, or disconcertingly ephemeral, or as several distinct, non-sequential sounds. So faintness or quietness at near 0 decibels or at the lower limits of my hearing for a given frequency may spawn as many disputes or dilemmas as exorbitant loudness. The noise of almost nothing tends therefore be interpreted toward the comfort. I'll do that again. The noise of almost nothing tends therefore to be interpreted toward the comfort of, say, voices from the dead coming through unrecorded magnetic tape, otherwise known as EVP or electronic voice phenomena, or through other etheric mediums, such as voices in seances. The noise of almost nothing may be less comfortably interpreted as the unfamiliar sounds of aliens or monsters. The noise of almost nothing may be amplified into something recognizable by allusion to other sound events, such as the music from our DNA or from yeast cells. Or, like other shape changers, the noise of almost nothing may be suspected as invasive and malign, such as that from high-tension wires. It may be indicted as the source of sleeplessness, mania, or diffuse anxiety. Or the noise of almost nothing may be associated with voices demonic or divine. The noise of almost nothing is so fertile precisely because it requires a commitment of time and presence with and for others in order to share the hearing of it. It is often eerie because of the strain required to keep hearing it or to ignore it once heard and not yet heard again. As for the second subset of noise, unidentifiable sounds may arise from sounds that call attention to themselves but are too loud, because in extreme loudness our ears have mechanisms to protect us from clarity, and the physical pain caused to eardrums may prevent our attending closely. Unidentifiable sounds may be too confused, because each of us has a limit to the number of sound events or sound streams we can equally well follow and decipher. We have a specific word for this, cacophony. Unidentifiable sounds may be too short, because although the latency between our ears receiving a sound and our brain registering it is less than for any other sense except perhaps the olfactory, there is always a delay between sensation and cognition. Unidentifiable sounds may be too truncated. That is, not impossibly brief, but sufficiently interrupted so as to leave one guessing. Unidentifiable sounds may be too isolated, because many sounds are so common that they require additional audio context in order to be decisively identified or told one from the other. Unidentifiable sounds may be simply too random, Because we listen for patterns, rhythms, variation, and when sound is absolutely random in its total and temporal fluctuations, we can only call it, quote, white noise, unquote. But in fact, many phenomena produce white noise, including waterfalls and cosmic background radiation. So even as white noise, the sound is not distinctive enough to be ascribed to any source without further context. Now, for the third subset of noise, the identifiable and intrinsically upsetting. Aside from the gride, which sound I will not repeat, there appear to be no other biopsychic sounds universally upsetting except perhaps that of a squalling infant. But an utterly silent baby is even more troubling, because likely very weak, ill, or mute from birth. Should it suddenly squall, that could be a wonderful sign. Intrinsic noise, then, is only noisy by contextual, historically shifting agreement about what is unwanted sound. This agreement may be generational, cultural, social, ethnic, political, and/or religious, and I follow all of these in making noise. For example, very loud sounds, sufficient to cause a temporary ringing in the ears, to knock out a few cilia in the cochlea, and to leave an auditor with temporary threshold shifts that make it difficult or impossible to hear certain frequencies at any ordinary decibel level, are still sought out by devotees of heavy metal, thrash, screamo, and what's called noise music. Are these intrinsically noisy? Nonetheless, we can break down this third subset of noise into telling categories, not all mutually exclusive, and all in one way or another interruptive, intrusive. Shrill sounds, for example, which may upset us because they feel physically piercing, because they pierce through more pleasant sounds, or music, or a comforting quiet. Because when sudden, shrill sounds cause inadvertent goosebumps, and when persistent, make one unable to hear oneself think. Another part of the subset of noise as intrinsic would be repetitive but unrhythmic sounds, which may upset because they invoke, then frustrate our desire for rhythm, measure, and closure, and usually cannot be ignored. Then there are loud but inconstant sounds, which, until they become very loud sounds, seem to be intrinsically annoying. Then there are low beaming but inconstant sounds, which may also make the body or bones shake. Then there are those progressions of notes or chords in a foreign or unfamiliar scale or mode, which upset because they contain what we may hear as dissonances, not keyed to any familiar or expected resolution. Then there are sounds resonant of pain, shame, humiliation, anger, hunger, or death, which upset us insofar as we sympathize with what we hear to be sounds of suffering, despair, shock, or loss, and because when hearing them over and over, we may become emotionally spent or psychically drained. Then there are those sounds that violate rituals of listening, protocols of conversation, and earnest forms of communication. For example, the crinkling of cellophane wrappers at classical music concerts, a vehement profanity in lieu of speech, uncontrollable, hyena-like laughter in the middle of lovemaking, political debates, stockholders' meetings, or a diplomatic entente. Then there are sounds that repeatedly interfere with speech and meaning, as, for example, stuttering, ticking, hemming and hawing, sputtering, mumbling, all of which we may forgive as inadvertent, but they remain identifiable as noise. Then there are sounds out of place or time which upset us because they disrupt our understanding of how the world proceeds and how indeed it should proceed, such as the otherwise cheerful sound of a steam calliope at a somber funeral, or at 3 in the morning. Then there are sounds with a dreadful personal entailment, which upset us individually because intimately associated with earlier trauma and grief, reminding us of cruelties or anguish we would prefer to forget, and which can upset larger cohorts if the trauma was widespread, as for example, the sound, the noise of a hurricane, tornado, or tsunami. And finally, silence itself, which can be felt as noisy when a form of political resistance, or at the heart and heat of a furious argument, or when imagined as the final scene of a catastrophic apocalypse, for example, a post-nuclear world with no living survivors, or just one. And now, we are back full circle to the noise of almost nothing.